Okay, we're on page 183. We're on page 183, paragraph 24. The rabbi says, "You have shamed me, king of the Khazars. You have shamed me." Probably the most famous line in the entire book of the Kuzari. Ho vashtani melech Khazar. I am ashamed of your words because I have no good answer for your accusation that diaspora Jewry are hypocritical. I have no response. Now, in order for us to properly understand the words of the rabbi to the Khazar king, I want us to recall the analogy that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi had given about what it means for a Jew to live in Eretz Yisrael. If you recall, several weeks ago, we learned that the rabbi had suggested to the Khazar king that a Jew living in Eretz Yisrael is a superior human being. And we had mentioned that any time that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi talks about a superior human being or an elite human being, he's referring to the ability for the human being to be a prophet, to prophesy. And this immediately led the Khazar king to question that. He says, I've never seen the people living in the Middle East claiming any superiority to people living in other places. What makes the people living in the region of Israel so special? So the rabbi's response was to give him an analogy. His analogy was to a vine. Remember that the analogy of the vine? He says, you have a vine that is capable of producing the finest grapes. There's only one problem. It's not planted in the right soil. And so no matter how good of a species that vine is, if you don't plant it in the right soil that has the proper nutrients, it's not going to grow and produce the best quality grapes. And there's one other thing that you need. You need three sort of components to produce a superlative grape. You need a good vine, you need good soil, and what's the third thing, anyone remember?
Water?
No. Water, or, you know, in general, cultivation. You need to cultivate it properly. You need to water it. You need to fertilize it. You need to hoe the soil and aerate it and do all of the things that farmers do that I know absolutely nothing about. Right? If you're growing a vineyard. So the problem is, so what are the three things in the analogy? The Jewish people are the excellent vine. We have inherently within us the greatest ability to produce greatness on a spiritual level. That's Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's thesis. We've spoken about it many times before. Eretz Yisrael represents the soil, which is able to, when the Jew attaches oneself to Eretz Yisrael, he is planted firmly in a place of greatest potential for spiritual growth. But the third ingredient is the cultivation. And that cultivation is the presence of a temple. It is the avoda, it is the service in the temple, and it is the sincere effort that is made on behalf of each and every Jew to be able to make sure that his or her vine grows in the most excellent way possible. Now, the shame that the rabbi is admitting to the Khazar king is that Eretz Yisrael is only as good as the effort that is put into Eretz Yisrael. And if we don't come to Eretz Yisrael with enthusiasm, and we don't put in the effort to Eretz Yisrael, we will not see the produce being grown in Eretz Yisrael that we would like to see happen. And therefore, this is exactly what happens to the Jewish people throughout history. Because we are less than enthusiastic about Eretz Yisrael does not provide us with a desired benefit. The challenge that the Khazar king had presented to the rabbi was that, I haven't seen you in a long time.
I wasn't sure. You missed the coffee.
Yeah. So he said, I didn't know, you Jews always pray to God to return his presence to Zion. You always bow down to the Holy Land. But no one's really trying to get there. No one's making a sincere effort to go to Eretz Yisrael. It's not on the to-do list, like we learned, the bucket list, like we learned last week. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. It's really not necessary.
But I feel bad if I get myself one.
No, I don't want you to. I don't want you to not come to class. In other
words. No, it's okay. Thank you. No problem.
So the rabbi says, "You're right. We are hypocritical. We don't live. We don't. We talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk. We don't practice what we preach." We express this great desire for God's return to Zion. But if we're not willing to return to Zion, why should we expect God to return to Zion? Why should we expect the great qualities of Eretz Yisrael to manifest themselves when we are not willing to actually go back and create that communion between God and the Jewish people? And so the rabbi says, this is exactly our shortcoming that occurred in Jewish history. And he says it is this very sin which prevented us from achieving that which God promised us for the Second Temple. As it says, "Rejoice and be happy, daughter of Zion, for I am coming and will dwell in your midst, says God." Zechariah says, "I'm going to come back. Roni v'simchi bas Tzion is from one of the last prophets of Israel," which means it is being pronounced at a time when the Jewish people are preparing or are in the process of building the Second Temple. And Hashem tells them, "I'm coming back to you. Just build the temple and I will return to Zion together with you." And yet we see that that fulfillment did not take place. God did not return back to Zion. At least not in the same way that he had promised that he would. And certainly not in the same way that he had been in the first temple. This means that the divinity was prepared to dwell in the second temple as it had previously in the first temple, provided that the Jewish people would all agree to return to Eretz Yisrael eagerly. Instead, only some returned, while the majority, including the important leaders, remained in Babylon. They preferred subservience in the diaspora so that they would not have to part from their homes and affairs. And as it turns out, the majority of Jews did not return to Zion. And so guess what happened as a result? Because the majority did not return to Zion, God said, "I'm not going to be the only one to show up to the party. If you're not coming, why should I bother showing up? I will show up in a way that is commensurate with your showing up. Your showing up was lackluster, so my showing up will also be lackluster." And so, one of the things... Midah keneged midah, bidiyuk. One of the things that we know that did not exist in the Second Temple was that there was no Aron. A lot of people don't know this, that there was no Ark in the Second Temple. If you were walking into the Holy of Holies in the Second Temple, you would be walking into an empty room. The Gemara does say that there was an illustration of the Ark on the wall of the Holy of the Holies, of the Holy of Holies. But when the Kohen Gadol walked into the Kodesh HaKodashim on Yom Kippur, he was not sprinkling the blood of the sacrifices on the Aron Kodesh. There was no Aron Kodesh. He sprinkled the blood on the place where the Aron Kodesh had previously resided. And there was this place called the Evan Shesia, the rock, which is where, according to legend, this is the legend that Haram al-Sharif is presently over the Dome of the Rock. It's not clear whether that was actually the place or not. But there was no Ark in the Second Temple. And as a result of there not being the Ark, we know, where does Hashem say that my Shekhinah will reside? Bein Shnei HaKeruvim, between the two cherubim that are on the ark. When there's no ark, the divine presence does not return, at least not in the same intensity. Now we also know, our sages tell us, that Lo Zaza Shechina Mikotel HaMa'aravi. You probably have heard that at some point, that you know that there's a Shekhinah at the Kotel, right? So we have to appreciate the fact that there are different words that are used to describe, I mean, the same word is used to describe different things. The word Shekhinah describes different kinds, different levels of Shekhinah. In one respect, the Shekhinah never left the Western Wall, in the sense that there is always some level of residual Shekhinah in the area of the temple, even to this day. But the Shekhinah, which was responsible for causing daily miracles in the first temple, that intensity of Shekhinah, that intensity of godliness that was palpable, no longer appeared in the second temple. And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi says, it is a direct result of the behavior of the Jewish people who came to build the second temple. It had nothing to do with the fact that, by definition, a second temple is going to be inferior to a first temple. Not at all. He quotes from Zechariah, Hashem says, I'm ready to come back, we'll do it all over again, and we'll have a wonderful relationship the second time. But, sorry, Bnei Yisrael themselves failed to show. And therefore, Hashem said, I'm not going to show up either. So this is you hear the tragedy, you hear the tremendous melancholy, the sadness in Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi's voice when he says this. If only, if only, if only, if only we had done our job, if only we had been prepared to enthusiastically return to Eretz Yisrael when the call came, look at what we could have accomplished. You know, I had quoted this passage in the Kuzari a couple of weeks ago on Shabbos, in reference to the fact that, you know, we know that when the original Chalutzim came to back to Israel, even before the founding of the state, the vast majority of them were not observant Jews. They were not religious Jews. And this led a number of rabbis in the end of the 19th, the beginning of the 20th century, to suggest that the entire Zionist project could not possibly be the will of God. Because how could Hashem allow the redemptive process to take place via Mechalalei Shabbat, through people who were Mechalal Shabbos? If Hashem really wants to bring the Jews back to Zion, he'll make sure that it's done through people with long beards, that are Talmudic scholars, that are pious people. If that's really what Hashem wants, that's the way he would do it, right? But Rav Kook, one of the arguments that he made is, he says, take a look at what history shows us. History shows us not that way. When it came time for Ezra and Nehemiah to rebuild the temple 2,500 years ago, and they made that call to people, come, we're rebuilding the temple, let's all come back to Eretz Yisrael. Do you think it was the men in the long beards who showed up to come? The vast majority of them had become comfortable in Bavel, and they stayed behind. You know who showed up? The people who didn't have that sense of comfort religiously, or socially, or familially. These were the people who came back to Eretz Yisrael. They figured they were not well ensconced in their communities. Perhaps they didn't even have a sense of community. So much so to the point where we read in Sefer Nehemiah that Nehemiah says, I'm so happy that you people are here. I just have one request. Divorce your non-Jewish spouses. Now, can you imagine that? If we're talking about very, very frum people who are coming back to build the second Beis HaMikdash, I could hear maybe someone said, you know, from now on we're just going to have Chal of Yisrael. We're not going to allow, you know, Hershey's anymore in the Beis HaMikdash. But no, that's not the policy. The policy is from now on we need to ask you to not bring your non-Jewish spouses to the Beis HaMikdash. You need to divorce them. I mean, just think about it for a second. This is the quality of people that we're dealing with. Nehemiah tells the people that for the first time in decades, we're going to celebrate the holiday of Sukkot, according to Halacha. And Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi will quote this later on, but he tells the people, I know you haven't done this in a long time, but I want you to go out and collect branches of wood. We're going to build sukkahs for the first time, perhaps for some people in their lives. This is recorded in the Navi. And everyone went out and they built a sukkah and they got Arba Minim. And this, for some people, it had been the first time they'd ever performed this mitzvah. So you see that you can't assume, you know, you have this idyllic image in your mind that the people who built the second Beis HaMikdash were all from, they look just like us, they behave just like us. It's not true. Historically, it's not accurate. And so you have to eliminate that vision from your mind. People who came back to build the second Beis HaMikdash, the leadership was absolutely religious. The leadership were Nevi'im. But the people who joined them, many of them, if not most of them, did not have those religious inklings and sensitivities as the leadership did. So therefore, Rav Kook, one of his arguments, of his many arguments, is no one can disqualify the redemptive process of the modern state of Israel by virtue of the fact that it was done by chalutzim who were not religious. Because we know historically that many times that's how the redemptive process begins. The only caveat that we would add is that for what Rabbi Yehuda Levi is telling us is that because it was not the leaders of the Jewish community who came back to build the second Beis HaMikdash, then that would explain why it was not a miraculous process. That would explain why there were so many problems in building the second temple. It would also explain why that even though we had religious autonomy, we didn't have political autonomy for most of the Second Temple period. You cannot look at the Second Temple period and say that it was anywhere near as glorious and beneficial for the Jewish people as the First Temple period. Because the First Temple period, we had our own monarchy. We were the major superpower in the Middle East for several decades, if not centuries. And that was not the case. In the Second Temple period, we were first under the control of the Persians, then the Medians, then the Greeks, and then the Romans. There was very little, and there was even a time when we didn't even have religious autonomy under the Hasmonean, under the Greek oppression until the Hasmoneans broke through. So, from Rabbi Yehuda Levi's perspective, this is all a result of the lackluster performance and enthusiasm of the Jewish people to build the Second Temple. So you look at the modern state, it's got a lot of problems. But how can you blame the Ribono Shel Olam and say, well, this can't be the Ratzon Hashem, you know, if so many people died and it was done through Chalutzim, that they go hand in hand. If all of Klal Yisrael would have come back en masse and the leadership, the Torah leadership, would have brought everyone with them, then maybe we wouldn't need to fight a war every 5 to 10 years. Maybe that wouldn't be necessary because there would be a different kind of relationship between us and the Ribono Shel Olam. I don't know. I'm just saying that you cannot look at circumstances and extrapolate that, well, you know, this can't be the will of God. How can there be so many wars? It's simple. We didn't come back the same way we didn't come back to build the second temple. And look, it was not as miraculous as the first temple was. For the very simple reason is that we were not as enthusiastic. So if you don't have all of world Jewry behind the Medina, so then it's not surprising that the Medina faces adversity. And that things work most of the time al pi derech hateva, using natural means to be able to succeed. So, you know, looking at it in this broader sense, a lot of the things that go on in Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael today make a lot of sense based on the fact that, you know, a large percentage of the people that are running the state are not religious, but it's not their fault. In other words, those are the people that started the state. Okay. So, anyone who wants to jump in at any time, this would be the time to jump in. Go ahead.
But in Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's example that you just spoke about the three ingredients needed, I feel like the way it's described, it makes it sound like those three ingredients are equal value, like 33.3%, 33.3%, and 33.3% to make up a whole. But I don't really see it that way because you see great people in the diaspora who are the vine and have the cultivation but don't have the land, and you see people in Israel who are the vine and have the land but are so far from Torah.
They don't have the cultivation.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But so my point is, I don't think those three ingredients are equal.
They may not be, but who's to say?
Me.
Can you honestly say that a Jew who's Shomer Shabbos in the diaspora is by definition better, by virtue of their Shemirat Shabbat, better than the Jew who's living in Eretz Yisrael? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know God's system. I'm just asking if you feel that way. My response is, ich weiß nicht.
No, I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm saying that over the course of history, great people have emerged in the diaspora. And at the same time, we see people in Israel who are so far from Torah. So it just leads me to believe that those three ingredients are not equal.
I don't see how you're coming to that conclusion. Everyone has free will. Everyone has free will to choose to either cultivate themselves, their vines, or not to cultivate their vines. But what does one have to do with, what does it have to do with whether you live in the diaspora or not?
Because if you're saying that those three things are necessary
for what?
To have a Jew who reaches
their maximum
really
potential.
High level.
Yeah.
So if you have someone like the Rambam who lived in the diaspora and was such a great person, he only had two of those elements. But you have people who live in Israel who also have two of those elements, but who are so far from Torah.
Yes. Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah. I think that's
but
a fair statement.
But how much more so, we don't know what his potential would have been had he also been living in Israel.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And remember, the Rambam doesn't agree with Reb Yehuda Halevi in the first place. The Rambam does not subscribe to this idea that the only way to reach your maximum potential is by living in Eretz Yisrael. We have yet to explore, that's what I did with my class last night for the guys. We talked about the machlokas between Reb Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam as far as reaching one's maximum potential, and Rambam seems to disagree with the Reb Yehuda Halevi. But I see your point. Your point is that as far as contributions to the Jewish people, there seem to be people in the diaspora who are great examples, who have made far greater contributions than individuals who are living in Eretz Yisrael. But you're not comparing apples to apples. You're comparing apples and oranges. There are plenty of people who, this is Reb Yehuda Halevi's point, as Linda's saying, if they had lived in Eretz Yisrael, they would have reached that much higher. That's the point. That
he's not talking about that, though. Is he's not talking about contribution, like how great your contribution if you live outside the diaspora. I mean, that's a separate issue. He's just talking about
the individual's potential, right? Yeah. And here in this paragraph, he's talking about the national level of what we can, what we are able to accomplish as far as bringing the Shekhinah to Hashem on a national level. On a national level, we can bring the Shekhinah down depending upon how enthusiastic we are as a nation in coming back to Eretz Yisrael. Now, here in the beginning of paragraph 2 on the bottom of page 183, he launches into a discussion of Shir HaShirim. There is, and I'll just, we won't start the text today because we're a little bit short on time, but I'll just use, my preface is that there are a number of you who may have read an essay by Rav Soloveitchik, which he wrote in 1956, called Kol Dodi Dofek, Behold My Beloved Knox. If you haven't, I spoke about it a couple years ago in one of the latest classes on Shabbos. If you haven't read the essay, I would encourage you to look for it online somewhere. Rabbi Joseph Baer Soloveitchik, Behold My Beloved Knox. It's based upon a passage in Shir HaShirim, the fifth chapter of Shir HaShirim, of the Song of Songs, in which this analogy is brought in Shir HaShirim of someone who, a lady, who has already gotten into her pajamas and gotten into bed and taken off her shoes and bathed herself and is under the covers, and all of a sudden she hears the knock of her beloved on the door. And she says, I am aniya sheina velibi er. I'm in that quasi-sleep state where I'm falling asleep, but I'm still somewhat awake. And I hear the knock of my beloved on the door, and I can even see his hand putting his hand through this lock on the door. There's a hole in the door, and I can see his hand trying to push through or wave to me. But you know what? I'm already in my pajamas. I've already retired for the evening. It's a big pain for me to get out of bed and to put my shoes back on and to put my clothes back on and to walk all the way to open the door. I'm half asleep. And so, by the time I finally do pull myself out of bed, because he keeps on knocking, I get to the door, and he's not there. He's not there anymore. He's already walked away, because he's given up. And so I run to find my beloved, and then the chapter continues, and seeing where my beloved is gone. So that's chapter 5 of Shir HaShirim. As you can imagine, Rav Yehuda Halevi is going to use this idea of Kol Dodi Dofek, my beloved is knocking. This was the call of Zechariah. Zechariah said, Rani v'simchi bas Tzion, ki hineni va, rejoice and be happy, daughter of Zion, because I'm coming, be ready for that day when we'll be reunited once again. And yet, Shlomo HaMelech describes the Jewish people as, we've gotten into our pajamas, we've gotten into bed already, we're exhausted, I have to get out and answer the door, and get out of bed, and walk all the way to the door. By the time we finally come in this very lackluster fashion, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you haven't come, you didn't run to the door as I was hoping you would, as a sign of your love, so I've moved on, says Hashem. And this is the representation of the way the Shekhinah felt, God's divine presence felt, when the Jewish people did not come back in full force to build the second Beis HaMikdash. Rav Soloveitchik used the idea of Kol Dodi Dofek to tell us that there are knocks on the door that every Jew has to hear in the 20th century with the establishment of the modern state of Israel. And whether or not you subscribe, he identified 6 different knocks at the door that basically represent paradigm shifts in the identity and the history of the Jewish people that were altered because of the establishment of the modern state of Israel. And sometimes people don't want to hear the knocking. Sometimes people are half asleep, and it's too much of a pain in the neck to acknowledge the knock on the door. But nevertheless, that's the point. And so without going into further detail about the essay, if you want, maybe next time we'll take a look at it, but I would encourage you to find it and see for yourself what the 6 knocks are.